And commentator Frank DeFord has his own take on the New York Yankees.
I don't believe in voodoo or evil eyes or curses, especially in sports. I never believed in the curse of the Bambino upon the Red Sox or that a goat has cursed the Cubs. However, I do firmly believe that if there are curses or that there should be curses, then the New York Yankees will be cursed forever, starting right now. This is what the team gets for erecting a 35-square-foot graven image to immortalize their late owner, George Steinbrenner, a glitzy monument to his pomposity and excess that positively dwarfs the monuments of the other Yankees who actually played baseball, thus rendering the glorious likenesses of Ruth and Gehrig, DiMaggio and Mantle as just so many little Facebooks in the crowd. There's already a joke going around that the only three things made by man that you can see from a satellite in outer space are the Great Wall of China, the pyramids, and the plaque of George Steinbrenner at Yankee Stadium. But the curse aside, as the playoffs begin today, it would appear that the Yankees are most unlikely to be able to repeat as champions. It is especially instructive that the quartet of stalwarts who have been the core of the club for so long, Derek Jeter, the noble captain, Jorge Posada, the yeoman catcher, Andy Pettit, the reliable southpaw, and Mariano Rivera, the inscrutable closer, all have begun almost together to start to crumble. Both Pettit and Posada were shelved with injuries this year, and Rivera, surely the best reliever ever, three times blew saves in September. We are advised now that he is working on his motion. Mariano Rivera working on his motion? It sounds as odd as Vincent van Gogh working on his brushstrokes. As for Jeter, since June, he has played his age, which is 36, and which is, particularly, historically, long in the tooth for short stops. Jeter's 10-year contract concludes this year. Obviously, he and the Yankees will stay the course together. Among other realities, Jeter is simply worth more to the Yankees as their icon than he is to any other team as an ordinary player. The Yankees will pay him the baseball version of a golden parachute to stick around and lend his class to the crass a little while longer. Derek Jeter, shortstop emeritus. But for now, notwithstanding the talents of CeCe Sabathia and Mark Teixeira and, of course, A-Rod, and the multitude of other stars that the Yankees have bought and paid top dollar for, the simultaneous erosion of the team's four horsemen seems to symbolically portend the end for the defending champions. You get the feeling that the last hurrah was last year. And then there's that new curse to contend with, too.
Frank DeFord, whose long and storied history of commentary makes him the New York Yankees of commentators. He joins us each Wednesday from member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montagne. For the last decade, Google has dominated online advertising with its search ads. When you search for, say, earplugs, Google gives you an ad link to a company that would love to sell you earplugs. But last week, Google put up an old-fashioned billboard in the middle of Times Square. The point was to remind everyone that they're also in the display ad business. Those are the ads with pictures. As NPR's Lara Seidel reports, Google is one of many companies vying for a big piece of a display ad market, a market that's becoming more targeted and more lucrative.
The colorful automobile advertisement on your computer 5 years ago may not look different from the one you see today, but behind the scenes, it sure is different. Let's imagine an internet user named Jane Smith, who was online looking at cars on the General Motors website.
As Jane visited the website, they placed a cookie on her browser.
The tracking device for GM shows Jane was looking for a car, explains Michael Baker of DataZoo, which advises online advertisers.
They've measured the fact that you came to their website, but you did not buy.
But they know Jane was looking and is probably on the market for a car. The cookie lets them follow her.
As she continues surfing, she next goes to CNN.
And guess what Jane sees?
She sees an ad for a new car.
And what they know about you can get even more personal, says Joanna O'Connell, who follows online display advertising for Forrester Research.
Your gender, your age, your household income, you know, whether you have children, psychographic information, like whether or not you consider yourself to be an introvert or an extrovert or a liberal or conservative.
And if you registered for something, say a Yahoo email account, you give the company your name, gender, birth date, and zip code, says Mitch Spolin of the company's ad division.
There is certain information that they volunteer when they are registered that we can leverage to deliver even a more targeted message to them.
Yahoo runs something called an ad exchange. It's a computerized auction for ad placement. This is how it works. When Jane Smith arrives on a particular web page, say Yahoo Finance, all sorts of information about her is sent to the exchange. In a millisecond, advertisers may know that Jane is looking for a car, that she's a mother of three, lives in Phoenix, and has a household income of $150,000. Advertisers looking for someone like Jane will bid to put an ad in front of her.
And we have thousands of advertisers that are bidding real-time in these impressions to reach the target audience that they're seeking.
Jane's eyes go to the highest bidder. The result is that Jane may see an ad for an SUV that's family safe and is for sale where she lives in Phoenix. Analyst O'Connell says this kind of targeted advertising is what's helping to revive online display ads.
You know, it's less waste, it's a better impression for them, and they're going to be willing to pay more.
In the last 20 years, online ads keep getting more targeted. From food ads on the cooking site to the search ads Google pioneered. And according to the analyst firm eMarketer, the U.S. display ad market is set to grow from just over 34% of online ads to more than 40% by 2014. But the new world of targeted display ads is going too far, says Jeff Chester, the executive director of the Center for Digital Democracy.
So you're talking about a commercial system that's a digital dossier about your innermost secrets, concerns, and personal matters. And that should not be available so people can target you or, frankly, your kids.
Chester says it can be information many people don't want public. Health conditions, financial matters, plus increasingly people are taking care of business and doing their banking online.
And these big institutions, these Fortune 1000 companies, these big advertising companies, not only do they know that, but they're studying those behaviors very closely.
Proposed legislation could give consumers more control over their own information, but the industry will regulate itself because they don't want to offend potential customers, says analyst Joanna O'Connell. She says many people find it creepy when an ad follows them around.
There's sort of the human element, the sort of ick factor, and marketers are aware of that. Depending on the marketer, there are some that are very reticent about using certain types of targeting.
And O'Connell says seeing ads is part of the deal consumers have to live with if they want free online content, because ads are the only way to pay for it. While many consumers may be happy to watch an ad, they may not be willing to give up so much of their privacy. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Learn more about the music and artists you hear on NPR and discover new music by visiting npr.org/music. There you can also hear a Tiny Desk concert or get an exclusive first listen of new music. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The Troubled Asset Relief Program, most commonly known as the TARP, officially expired 2 days ago. Congress passed the massive $700 billion bailout back in October 2008, at the height of the financial panic when the stock markets were tanking and credit markets were freezing and the threat of another Great Depression loomed large. At the time, the TARP was passed with bipartisan support. Many economists agree that the program, in large part, has been a success. And yet, as described by Herb Allison, TARP has become such a dirty word in our nation's discourse, few terms elicit such anger from voters or from politicians. Herb Ellison oversaw TARP at the Treasury Department for the last 15 months, and he joins us now from our bureau in New York. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Robert. Great to be here.
This program is being vilified in this political campaign season by both Democrats and Republicans, and yet, by most accounts, it's been a financial success. How do you reconcile those two things?
Well, first of all, no one liked to bail out the big banks, and it's been described as a moral hazard that the taxpayers' money was put to work to protect the interests of the few in the banking industry. But as a matter of fact, Robert, there was really no alternative at the time. Given the depth of the crisis, it was a true national emergency, and there was really no alternative. And I think that, it's hard to prove a negative. It's hard to really demonstrate what the economy would have been like if TARP had not been created. It kind of reminds me, though, of the movie It's a Wonderful Life, because as you recall in the movie, George Bailey is shown what his hometown would have looked like had he not lived, and things are pretty tough.
You think America would have been reduced to a national Potterville or Pottersville if there had been no TARP?
It might well have. In fact, there is an attempt to illustrate what the country might have looked at without TARP, and that's a study done by Alan Blinder and Mark Zandi, where they indicated without TARP and some associated programs, you might have seen unemployment at 16% or more and the economy literally grinding to a halt.
Let's talk about the actual numbers here. The original $700 billion, that amount was never actually spent. It was capped at $475 billion, is that right?
Yes, and in fact, only about $387 billion was actually invested. And I'm very pleased that at this point, we've already recovered more than half of the funds that were invested. We're now down to about $180 billion. And three-fourths of the money that was invested in banks has been returned. And the government, the taxpayer, in other words, will earn a profit on the money that was invested in banks.
$82 billion went to the auto industry, to Chrysler and GM. Money also went to their financial arms and to auto suppliers. How much of that money will be recouped ultimately?
Well, we've already received some of that money back to taxpayers. And as you know, GM has announced it intends to do its initial public offering as a new company in November. And that will pave the way for the government to sell its common stock ownership in GM over the next several years. And we expect that we'll recover the large portion of that funds, if not perhaps all the funds, over a period of time.
Although at the moment, the GM public offering, it hasn't yet taken place, but it looks like the value of the company is a little bit less than had been hoped for.
That could be. We'll see what the market's like when the actual offering takes place. But we're hopeful that the public will receive most of the money back and perhaps all of it.
Again, the biggest share of the money went to the banks, but there also was $70 billion that went to the insurance giant AIG. Any hope of actually seeing that money back?
Well, as we're reporting today in a two-year retrospective on the TARP program, if you valued our stake in the company at the current market value of the firm, we ought to get back all of the money on behalf of taxpayers and perhaps earn a profit.
I've seen it claimed that perhaps the real net cost to taxpayers from all this, far from that original $700 billion that was never spent, is more like $50 billion.
Yes. And if you look at the Treasury's overall holdings, including TARP and some other holdings in AIG, the total cost to Treasury may be as low as $30
billion. What do you make of this? I mean, you were, first of all, I should point out, you were a holdover from the Bush administration. You were a former financial chair for John McCain's first presidential run. You're not a partisan Democrat by any means. Do you think part of the problem here was that the big banks seemed to recover all too quickly? That is, given the size of the effort, they were, within a matter of a few months, saying, oh, we're up and running again. We're okay. People who lost their jobs, people who were underwater on their mortgages, people who saw their 401ks drop by huge amounts, are still struggling terribly and making all sorts of deep cuts in their own finances to make it work. In a sense, the success of the TARP seems almost, you know, thumb Washington's nose at people out there.
Well, I think, first of all, TARP is only one of the programs now underway to help restore economic health. There are still funds to be invested by the ARRA Act, the American Reinvestment Recovery Act. That's going to be helping. There are still TARP funds invested in smaller banks. You see new housing programs that are active today in recognition that these problems are far from over. People are still suffering out there. They still need assistance. And it's also going to take time to rebuild confidence. This is going to be most likely a fairly slow recovery. That's frustrating to everyone, including everyone in the administration who are working. Take it from me. I've been there night and day to try to make things better for Americans.
Herb Allison, who oversaw the Troubled Asset Relief Program, the TARP, at the Treasury until just a few days ago. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Novelist Philip Roth turned 77 this year. It's been half a century since he published his first book, Goodbye Columbus, and won a National Book Award. Today, Roth releases his 31st effort. It's called Nemesis. The story is set during World War II in Roth's hometown of Newark, New Jersey. The nemesis of the title is a polio epidemic. In a moment, we'll hear from Philip Roth, but first, Alan Shoes has a review.
The narrator is one of the victims, named Arnie Mesnikoff, who recovered from his attack of polio. Through his eyes, we get a portrait of a 23-year-old Jewish playground director named Bucky Cantor, a young man who loomed large, in fact, seemed almost invincible in those days in the lives of some Jewish boys in summer. In reality, Cantor is much less than all-powerful. Despite his best intentions to fight for his country, the army rejects him because of faulty eyesight. And as the polio epidemic advances across his neighborhood and town, he seems unable to regard himself as anything but a pathetic figure who's been spreading the disease without taking sick himself. Where at the beginning of the epidemic, Bucky takes a Rooseveltian view that the germ of fear of the disease might be worse than the disease itself, by the end of the story, we see him, as the narrator puts it, as nearly having become one of those people taken to pieces by his times. This dual portrait of a neighborhood and of a man representative of the times gives this new novel a singular appeal. When bad things happen to good people, to borrow the title of a book by a contemporary American rabbi, crowds always gather to watch and wonder.
Alan Shoes teaches writing at George Mason University in Virginia.
In spite of all of the books written about George Washington, his status as legend and icon often overshadows the actual facts of his life. Ron Chernow's new book, Washington, A Life, is the latest attempt to examine the first president as man rather than myth. Reviewer Ralph Eubanks reports that Chernow's book is a bold and nuanced new biography, one that's worth the time it'll take you to read the 900-plus pages.
While painting one of his famous portraits, Gilbert Stuart discovered that George Washington was a different man from the cool, calm, and composed figure of his public persona. Stuart believed that he was, by nature, a man of fierce and irritable disposition. Never one to let his guard down, Washington resisted Stuart's attempts to get him to open up. He believed a man should be courteous to all, but intimate with few. While there have been numerous books written about him, few of them have given as complete a picture of our first president as Ron Chernow's compelling new biography, Washington, A Life. What helped Chernow write a biography that captures Washington's essence is the close reading he did of 60 volumes of letters and diaries published as part of the George Washington Papers Project, as well as numerous other works of scholarship. Now, before you think this is a book to shy away from, a mere regurgitation of historical facts and transcripts of moldy 18th-century correspondence, Washington, A Life, is far from that. It is a biography of Washington for the 21st century, one that examines his conflicts and foibles, as well as his triumphs. It is a psychological, as well as a historical portrait. Chernow makes sure the reader sees the tempestuous side of Washington that many knew lay under his calm demeanor, but was revealed to only a few. Through Chernow's narrative, the reader watches Washington transform himself from an insecure colonel in the French and Indian War to the president of a young nation. In the progression, a large cast of characters come in and out of the picture, providing a perspective on Washington's personal relationships and the strengths and weaknesses of his personality. Readers also get a sense of Washington's ambivalence about slavery. Chernow explains how Washington struggled with the idea of slavery, but fell back on the self-serving fantasy that it would fall away. Washington, a Life, keeps its distance from Washington mythology, and its narrative informs as much as it entertains. Starting with the book's epigraph, "Simple truth is his greatest eulogy," a quote from Abigail Adams. Chernow lets the reader know he wants to give an accurate portrayal of an enigmatic historical figure. In this book's pages, he does it in a way that not even the most gifted portrait artist of George Washington ever could.
The book is Washington, A Life by Ron Chernow. Our reviewer is Ralph Eubanks, author of The House at the End of the Road. He's director of publishing at the Library of Congress. And you can read an excerpt about that first portrait session with Gilbert Stuart and George Washington at our website, npr.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. In Hershey, Pennsylvania, you can't cruise past the factory on Chocolate Avenue without getting a whiff of that famous cocoa goodness. Next year, that sweet smell will be gone, along with 500 jobs. The Hershey Corporation says it's closing the historic factory and eliminating half the workforce. NPR's Jamie Terabay reports.
When Milton Hershey broke ground on this factory in 1903, he saw more than smokestacks and a brick building.
He didn't build a factory and said, oh, what do I need to do with my workers? I'll build a town. They went hand in hand and were developed simultaneously.
Pam Whiteneck is head of archives at the Hershey Museum. She says Hershey wanted to give his employees more than a paycheck. He wanted to create a workers' paradise. Inspired by another famous chocolate maker of his day, Cadbury, in England, Hershey provided low-rent housing, public transportation, and a water park. A lot has changed. At Hershey World, visitors can make their own candy bars. The amusement park and other recreational activities Hershey originally built for his workers now cater to tourists. The chocolate factory is no longer the biggest employer in town. The Hershey Medical Center is. The number of workers who actually make chocolate continues to shrink.
You know, they put new equipment in that ran faster, took less people to operate. You know, it was shrinking because of that.
Dennis Bomberger first began work at Hershey in 1967. He was 18 years old and made kisses.
The new plant is going to be making them exactly the same way. It's just newer equipment.
Hershey is spending $300 million on a new facility being built just outside town. 600 workers from the old factory will move there. The rest are being replaced by machinery. Hershey's reshaping itself to fend off global competition. It has a huge new competitor in Kraft, which recently bought Cadbury. Bomberger understands why the historic factory has to close. It's old and can't accommodate new equipment.
The ceilings are low and they do have a lot of columns in there that they'd have to go around.
Standing near a ticket counter at Hershey World, company spokesman Kirk Seville says Hershey is doing this to stay competitive.
We're creating a cost-effective, efficient facility that will enable us to compete with global players and meet the needs of customers and our consumers.
Hershey had wanted to move production out of the Pennsylvania town altogether, but decided to keep it here when the union agreed to the job cuts. That small consolation to some workers. Here at the Parkside Grill, the mood is one of uncertainty. It's still unclear who'll stay and who'll lose their jobs. There's already been one round of voluntary buyouts. Bob Laird is a local businessman whose fiancé works at the Hershey factory.
I hate to say it, but I think Milton's probably turned it over in his grave, saying things that have happened the last few years.
Laird sees the factory closure and job cuts as a sign of corporate greed and says it's a rejection of Milton Hershey's original vision of providing for his workers. Author Michael D'Antonio disagrees.
Oh, poor Milton Hershey has been turning in his grave so many times since he died that I imagine he's quite worn out. You know, he understood that all things change.
D'Antonio, who's written a book about Milton Hershey, says the legendary confectioner was, after all, a businessman and made decisions based on the market and the bottom line. Jamie Tarabay, NPR News.